Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a senior fellow for national security at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Washington Post columnist and author, Max Boot. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates, what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room, by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And also, please check out the link to our sponsor, Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. James Toosey was opening of the 2026 primaries. If Variety was covering it, the headline would be a boffo night for Democrats. State and Texas, where most of the attention was, state legislator James Tallarico, the stronger candidate, won an impressive primary over firebrand Jasmine Crockett, who then conceded after stalling for a while and embraced his candidacy. Democrats haven't won a Texas Senate race in 37 years. Tallarico, I think, has the best chance of anyone in that time. And in part, that's because on the Republican side, four-term Senator John Cornyn was forced into a runoff against Attorney General Ken Paxton, a man who radiates scandal and sleaze, but is loved by a lot of the right-wingers in Texas. Now, you know, this is a 12-week primary, James, and it's going to be enormously expensive and really dirty. I mean, already Cornyn is running against Paxton for sleeping with a married woman with seven children. That's pretty tough stuff, and it's going to get a lot worse. My guess is there will be huge pressure on Trump to intervene for Cornyn. He may well do that, but the conventional wisdom that Cornyn would be harder to beat, I think, may not be true after yesterday's showing. If after all that time in the Senate, you can't beat a guy like Paxton, I think you're in trouble. I also would note that I think overall the Democrats got more votes than the Republicans in two very contested contests. That probably is unusual in Texas. And Tallarico rolled up really big votes in Latino districts, particularly in South Texas, all over the state. Right now going into this, I would say James Tallarico is at least a 50-50 and probably better shot to be the next senator from Texas.
So a guy that I read, I don't know him, but we got to get this guy on the show, G. Elliot Morse. He's probably the most articulate quant there now. And he had an article that I thought was pretty convincing. You know, it's six reasons why Texas is going to be competitive for Democrats. And he goes through everything, what you talked about, but it's a very good distillation of where it is. And we got, you know, the other guy we got to get Billy McGalla on the show. He's really, really smart. He's Paul's kid, and he lives in Austin, and he's very involved and very knowledgeable about Democratic politics in Texas. But for the meantime, I highly recommend
Well, we had Tallarico on.
Oh, no. Yeah, we'll get him back.
Yeah.
But you know, also our viewers, they liked, you know, that kind of detailed analysis and, you know, the backstage shit too. But anyway, I highly recommend the G. Elliot Morris piece, and I've come to kind of, he's like the new Nate Silver, but he's pretty good. He's a quant, but he's good. Yeah. But so yes, the news was good. Yeah, congratulations to Congresswoman Crockett. She, you know, and Jim said, look, if Jasmine wins, I will be at all the events for her. If the Democrats behaved, I thought, on the whole, pretty damn good. And I give you another reason for optimism. I'm in New York at this bridge conference. The goddamn in this party is just breathtaking. Okay. Rob Sand, I can't say enough complimentary about this guy's political skill. I really can't.
I am a gubernatorial candidate.
Yeah, I can't. It's hard for me to convey just how impressive and how he operates on the kind of on the ground level. I mean, this guy. You know, sometimes you see people in politics, and you say, well, this guy could be like a Clinton or Obama one day. If you're honest with yourself, there's very few people that you would say that about. He might be one that you know, if you saw him in spring, you might say, yeah, man, this guy could be like Sam Muslin, Ted Williams, or Aaron, or some kind of shit. You really have that feeling when you're around him. I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say some guy's a state auditor to Iowa. You'd probably be the governor. He's got like that kind of talent, you know, that level. But what I'm telling you is I wouldn't say it's impossible that he gets there one day at all. He's that talented. And you know, there were other people at this thing that really, you know, needless to say, Andy Beshear is like, if you don't know want to know how strong Andy Beshear is, look at the election returns in the, I guess it was 2023 Kentucky governor's race in Breathitt County, and look at the election returns in Breathitt County in the presidential election of 2024. It's fucking eye-popping. And you can't, I didn't believe it when he told me. And you know, we're the one thing we've learned, Al, is all of the stuff that a lot of our friends, and maybe some of us were thinking this, that there was some sort of permanent change when Delavolpe was there. We could get him back on. He's always insightful. And everybody said that there were these real changes among Hispanics and under 30. It looks like a fool today. And the thing that I would say to Democrats, it's almost certain we're going to have massive overperformance from 2024 with Hispanics and younger voters. But don't do what a lot of commentators did and a lot of Republicans did and assume that that's permanent. And my message to Democrats is you're getting the greatest opportunity you could have in politics. That is, you're getting a second look. For God's sakes, what I feel good about, when we get the second look, and we're going to get it, we have some fucking talent out there. We do. I'm sorry. I mean, we got some people worth looking at.
No, I think that's right. You know, and the other side's problems really were manifest on Tuesday. Just to take, I mean, we talked about the Texas Senate primary. Let me take a couple congressional races. I think it's the 23rd district, Mr. Gonzalez, he's the incumbent Republican, former staffer after he propositioned her, died of suicide. Republicans were praying he would lose. He didn't. He's in a runoff. They got at least 12 more weeks of the Gonzalez flap. And you know something? Win or lose the primary, unless they decide to kick him out, which they're petrified to do because their margin is so small, he'll be with them, and that issue will be with them for the rest of the year. Another one I would note was a guy who actually was a guest on this show, Dan Crenshaw. Dan Crenshaw is a very conservative Republican, a former Navy SEAL, and the Ted Cruz and the right wing, and actually Trump, refused to endorse him. Why? Because he was one of those who said, I'm sorry, the 2020 election wasn't stolen. That is not possible to say in the Texas Republican Party. But that's nothing but good news for Democrats.
Yeah, and so when I made this point, I was at the big donor conference and I told all these big Democratic donors last night, send a check right now. Okay, and the people that are listening to this, and maybe not of y'all can max out, okay, I find that. Whatever you do, go to your computer and send Tal Rico a check now. Now, I'll tell you why. This is my thinking. They got 12 weeks. It's May 26th. They are going, and by the way, talk about money in politics. They currently spent $77 million fucking dollars. You heard what I said? $77 million. And most of it came from Thune, from the Republican Senate Majority PAC. Think about that. 77, and they're going to spend that much in the runoff, and Paxton's going to spend a lot. And all they're going to kill each other. And if you send Jim Tallarico a check today, he is going to go on TV and is going to do 30-second ads talking about how we need to have Christian values and love our neighbor as ourselves and just all this shit. And while he's doing that, they're going to be fucking killing each other with every negative spot that you can imagine. Every freak show on the right wing is going to come out. I, 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 I got to tell you, man, this is a golden opportunity. And I think that a March dollar and an April dollar is equally to equal of an October dollar in Texas. So I'm urging everybody to, whatever you can, send the money now, because it's an expensive state and you have a golden opportunity. While they are just in the most cantankerous, you know, competitive primary that you can imagine, the divinity student has got great bedside manner. And I'm very big on that. I'm very big on Texas.
And James, I am, as I said earlier, I am no longer really worried. If Trump does get involved, and they somehow, if they force Paxton out, they won't force his voters out. Cornyn is weak. When you've been there for that long and you get 41% of the vote, you spent over $70 million. I'm sorry. That is a candidate who is just, he reeks beatable. And so I have thought, and most people thought for a long time, we prayed that Cornyn would lose the primary, that the easier guy to beat would be Paxton. I don't even know that that's true anymore. I also would note just a couple other things. We know in North Carolina that Roy Cooper is a prohibitive favorite. If there was any doubt, yesterday ended that doubt. Number one, Cooper got two obvious candidates running against Michael Whiteley, former party chair, former state party chair, endorsed by Trump. Cooper got far more votes. Whiteley only got 64% of the vote in a Republican primary. There's a guy running against him was endorsed by Michael Flynn and Michael and that crazy Robinson, who was a lieutenant governor, a total nutbag, and held the Republican candidate to 64. North Carolina, the only issue now is how big. And there's just nothing yesterday that looked anything but promising for Democrats in 2026.
So Morgan Jazzy's going to hate me for this, but I'll tell you what. I'm going to put it in the River Parish vernacular. I ain't studying about no North Carolina Senate race. We're going to win that goddamn thing. And I'm not going to waste my fucking time going to North Carolina. I'm going to South Carolina. Okay? I mean, we're going to have to do some arbitrage here, or I don't know, triage, or whatever, I guess you call it. And I think we're going to win North Carolina. Okay? I'm focusing, and I saw this morning, I talked to JB at the Senate Majority Pact, I talked to the donors, and I said, look, I'm fucking with South Carolina, Mississippi, Texas, and I got Florida on the watch. By the way, David Jolly, oh my God, this guy is so goddamn talented, it's just, it's unbelievable. Every time I see David Jolly.
He's running for governor, running for governor in Florida.
Right. As a Democrat. He was, as Al Hunt would have said, and he was a Republican congressman. He was actually a principled conservative. He was a deficit academic almost.
One of my kind.
One of your colleagues. And he was by any stretch of the
imagination. I've been looking for him for a long time.
Yeah, he's been looking for him. And I found the guy. But the problem is, he's a Democrat now. Yeah. He's very good. He says, yeah. I did not become a Democrat because I hated Trump. I became a Democrat because they had my values. I didn't change anything. The Democratic Party represented my values. That guy is so fucking good, you can't believe it. I'm very high on David Jolly.
My wife was at the Howard Baker Institute in Knoxville last night, and I said, I'm looking for Howard Baker. Could you find any? She said, no. I saw a lot of former Howard Baker people, but that was it. James, I think your list is good, but boy, don't forget Iowa and Ohio and Michigan, too. I mean, Rob Sands is a great candidate for governor, and I hope he can help bring a Democratic Senate candidate in with him. My candidate would be, I think his name is Turek. We had him on the show, the Paralympian. And I think Sherrod Brown's going to win that race in Ohio.
I got to call Turek. I got to call him to him. But hey, Turek, I'm just telling you right now, you're not raising enough money. Get on the goddamn phone and dial for cash. Okay? You could win that thing, but you got to take your fundraising more seriously. But he's a very good candidate. Rob is all-world candidate.
Yeah, now's the time to do it.
I talked to Andy Beshear last night.
Yeah.
And we got a candidate in Ohio for governor that's all-world. I mean, she's really good. I mean, DeWine's
all-world. Oh, she is terrific. She really is.
Yeah. Right.
She was the most popular person in the state a couple years ago.
And she's running for governor. She was the health commissioner under DeWine. She's really good. They don't have. We got to get your friend from Cincinnati, the lawyer on here, who's really knowledgeable about the internals on Ohio politics. But I think we wrote.
He's her. Wait, James. He's her running. He's her running mate. He's running for lieutenant governor. You know, David Pepper is her running mate.
Well, let's get him on the show because he's really good.
So let's get both of them on. We'll get them.
Yeah, let's get them on. Chip chair.
Yeah.
Oh man,
We
can get Tim Ryan to give us some commentary too. He's very, very knowledgeable, very smart. But yes.
No, I was going to say we promised a couple of weeks ago that we were going to have challengers on most weeks. You know, some things got in the way like war and everything, but we're going to continue with that. And we're going to get some of these really good challengers on in the next 4 or 5 months. So stay tuned.
Yeah. One of the things that I saw Wasserman, and everybody kind of thinks that Nevada too might be in play. And we want to get that person. And that's a big, a heavily Republican district. That's a Reno district. But they really believe that could be in play. And that would be a reach. But that's the kind of thing in a good year that you can win. And I've got to get the Nevada 2 guy, too.
Yep. And some of those Texas outcomes show that the Republicans ain't going to pick up a net of 5 because they're redistricting. They may be lucky to pick up, no more than 2 or 3. And in North Carolina,
I'm just saying, Wasserman did a detailed analysis of the changes that were made, and he thinks the Democrats net a half a seat. At the end of the day, after all the Texas and the California, Virginia, Utah, everything, he says it's a net half a seat for Democrats. Now that's a little arcane, but the point is, we didn't get hurt in the redistricting war.
Right. That is the important point. James, that reminds me of one final topic I want to bring up. Remember, Republicans have said all along, we shouldn't, on the Supreme Court, we shouldn't interfere. It's up to the states on gerrymandering. We're not going to do it. And we really don't believe in using race as a reason to throw something out. Guess what? They just threw out, Sam Alito and his Republican colleagues and that Republican Supreme Court threw out the New York redistricting because they thought that woman on Long Island was somehow racially discriminated against. Oh, really? Let's see how Sam and company vote on the voting rights bill, James. You think they're going to be consistent?
Understand. Okay. You live in a country and we have a Supreme Court. If they say something, you have to file it for one reason. You might go to jail. But other than that, there is no reason to be at all respectful or anything about anything they say. It is look at Clarence Thomas, look at Alito, look at Neil Gorsuch, look at the whole thing. It's totally fucking corrupt. It has no ethical standard. Okay. A goddamn third grader is held to more accountability than a fucking Supreme Court justice. And yeah, you make a decision. I'm not going to go to jail and defy it, but I'll do it under duress. That's what I think. That's what I think of Alito and that whole goddamn.
Listen, I'm going to tell you people out there, if you will tune in next week, James will tell you what he really thinks about this. He won't hold back. All right. Thank you. There's a lot to cover.
Upgrade your wardrobe with Quince. That stuff is unbelievable. I got to tell you, it's really affordable and it's really quality. These are well-made textiles. I got to tell you, they just are. And they're unbelievably affordable. Our producer's wearing Quince gear here today and he loves it.
You know, a thoughtfully built wardrobe relies on pieces that mix well and last. Now, that's where Quince shines, with premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel dependable and effortless to wear, even as the seasons change. Quince has the everyday essentials we love with quality that lasts. Think lightweight cashmere sweaters, short-sleeve Mongolian cashmere polos, linen bottoms and shorts, tees in 100% Pima cotton, and European jersey linen, and more. These are the versatile pieces that make a wardrobe actually work season to season. It's affordable also. Quince works directly with top factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. The cashmere is 100% Mongolian from the same stuff luxury brands use. The Pima cotton is long staple, which means it stays soft and it doesn't pill. The European jersey linen is breathable and lightweight, and everything is built to hold up to regular wear and still look good. Their clothing is rated between 4.5 and 5 stars by thousands of people wearing it every day. Plus, the only partner with factories that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production is Quince. The fits are perfect, the fabrics are incredible, and the style and options are unmatched. You should see how great James looks in the cashmere sweater. And one of my Quince favorites is their luxurious stretch wool dress pants. Can you see me, James, in those stretch wool dress pants? They feel amazing, and they're perfect for getting things done on the hill, meeting a source, or just reading by the fire in style. So stop overcomplicating your wardrobe. You don't need a closet full of options. You need a few pieces that actually work right now. Go to quince.com/warroom for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it, and you will. We also have some good news. Quince is now available in Canada. Also, don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/warroom for free shipping and 365-day returns. Again, quince.com/warroom. The link is in our show notes. James, in this extraordinary week, there's no one better to describe Trump's war in the Middle East, where the official rationale changes daily, sometimes hourly, than Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, award-winning author and columnist for The Washington Post. Max, we don't have time to list all the Trump administration's shifting explanations or speculation. Imminent nuclear threat, Israelis made me do it, regime change, existential need to obliterate their missiles, which are about to hit us. Please, Saudi Prince, MBS, wag the dog to get Epstein off the front page. They're countless, and they do change every day. Why do you think he started this war?
Well, that's a great question. I think the most convincing explanation I've seen is that there has been some reporting that Trump is looking to leave a historical legacy beyond, you know, simply the White House ballroom, that he wants to wipe out these regimes that have been a thorn in America's side for all these years. And so he deposed the leader in Venezuela. He's trying for regime change in Iran. And likely, if he's successful or even not so successful in Iran, he'll probably turn to Cuba next. So he's trying to make kind of a clean sweep of the board, I think, before he leaves office. And of course, this is coupled with his zanier ambitions to expand American territory by adding Canada or Greenland to the U.S.
Max, I'm not going to, I wouldn't miss any of those leaders, starting with Khamenei, but they have tried to say that this was a preemptive strike, that they were about to attack us. I think it's been clearly demonstrated, including from American intelligence, that's a lie. It was not a preemptive strike. They decided to do it. It was a war of choice. For all the good riddance of the Supreme Leader and others, there's a second day. It's not just the first day. The strikes and the intelligence were near perfect. We know that. But you understand this. I mean, you remember Iraq. It gets tougher now. So what do you see ahead, and what are some of the perils?
Well, that's a great question. And Alan, I think as a recovering Iraq war supporter, I have to say that there are some disturbing parallels here, including some, although there's some obvious differences, the big one being Trump doesn't seem to be seriously contemplating sending ground troops, but in the way that the justification for the war keeps shifting, and also the end state that we're seeking keeps shifting. But Trump is at least flirting with regime change, although if you listen to Pete Hegseth and Dan Cain at the Pentagon, they're talking about simply degrading Iraq's capacity to threaten its neighbors, which I think is certainly a doable and realizable military objective. I mean, there is no question that we are degrading Iranian military capabilities as we speak, but some of the more grandiose ambitions that Trump has expressed, I don't think are terribly realistic. And they're at odds with one another, because on the one hand, when he first announced the strikes, he told the Iranian people to rise up and the security forces to lay down their arms. But he's also been talking about how he'd love to see an Iranian Dulce Rodriguez, i.e. Some figure in the current regime who will make deals with him. And I don't think either one is terribly realistic. I don't think either one is going to emerge out of this bombing. But you're also seeing the administration now flirting with other options, including there have been reports that they're arming the Iranian Kurds. And I think that's something that's cause for great concern, because it sounds like in the pursuit of regime change that Trump may be willing to start a civil war in Iran. I don't think anybody really wants to see Iran become, you know, Syria 2.0, Libya 2.0, Afghanistan 2.0, and least of all, the Iranian people. And I think if there's one thing that would lead, Persian nationalists to rally around the regime, it's the threat of the U.S. arming separatists who are trying to destroy the Iranian state.
Well, I think what this underscores, and when you talk about helping the Kurds, the deja vu to 2003 comes back again. I think what this underscores is, Max, they didn't have any planning for day two. They just knew they could be tough in day one. I mean, look at all those poor Americans stranded in those countries over there. There was no preparation for that at all. Right. The shifting explanations, the lies, and again, there may be some good stuff that comes out of this, but I find it hard to believe Iran may be much weaker militarily in another year or so, and that's not a bad thing. I don't think it's going to – I find it hard to see how they're going to become a stable, semi-pro-Western country.
Yeah, I think that's very unlikely. I think the most likely outcome here is going to be that you're going to have the same Iranian regime with a new leader, but in a weakened military state. And so – you know, the analogy that is in my mind is kind of Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War, where Saddam Hussein was still in power and still had enough power to slaughter protesters rising up to challenge his rule, but was less of a threat to the region, it wasn't like it was a non-existent threat. It was enough of a threat to lead George W. Bush to lead America to war again in 2003. And so my concern is that this is going to be another long-term quagmire for the United States of the kind, by the way, that Donald Trump promised to pull out of when he ran for president. This is the opposite of what he was saying.
No more endless wars. We know that. Put yourself in Saran's shoes now. I know that's hard because we're not quite sure who is calling the shots. But what they are doing is they're striking targets in other Gulf countries. The administration says that's really counterproductive there. Yeah. On the other hand, maybe what their strategy is to have these countries who don't want a war bring pressure on Washington to stop this thing. Which do you think is more feasible, more reasonable, more likely?
I mean, I think that is their strategy. I think it's a twofold strategy. One is to put pressure on the Gulf states to in turn put pressure on Washington. And I'm sure Iran is very aware of the extent that MBZ and the UAE and MBS and Saudi Arabia, they exert massive influence over Trump in this White House. So If they're lobbying to end the war, that could have an impact. I think the other aspect of it is that Iran is simply trying to create turmoil and throw sand into the gears of the international economy to lead to a spike in oil prices, to a decline in stock markets, on the assumption that that will put economic pressure on Trump to end the war. And basically, fundamentally, at the end of the day, I think the Iranian strategy is simply to hunker down, absorb the bombs and missiles, in the expectation that they will be able to wait Trump out. I mean, he's basically put a timeline on this, saying it's going to last 4 weeks. I'm sure in the minds of Iranian leaders, they're thinking, well, our regime can survive 4 weeks of bombing. It's been here for, you know, since 1979. It's a very entrenched regime. And so I think their view is that they have more patience than Trump, who everybody knows tends to be kind of hyperactive, and his attention can rapidly wane. And I think in some ways, the analogy for the Iranians is what happened almost exactly a year ago with what the administration called Operation Rough Rider, where they started attacking the Houthis in Yemen and bombed them for nearly 2 months, but wasn't achieving that much. And finally, at the end of the day, Trump just negotiated kind of a face-saving deal with the Houthis and ended the bombing of the Houthis very much still entrenched in power.
Yeah. James Carville.
So, Bags, am I correct that you were born in the Soviet Union?
You are correct.
Okay. So, and we talk about warfare. Okay. And let's talk about Stalingrad. I think the Stalingrad is instructive here. The Germans had a very successful bombing campaign. All right. They reduced Stalingrad to rubble, which ended up beating them, because then the Russians could hide everywhere. And their bombing was actually so successful, they lost the fucking battle. The entire Sixth Army had to surrender. So I guess you're a student of history. And I mean, it'd be Hitler's thing, if you just kick the door down, yeah, everything will be fine. Well, you kicked the door down, but it wasn't fine. And wars have a way of getting away from you, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't push the Stalingrad analogy too far, because this is not a ground war. But I think you're correct in that what you can. I think the larger takeaway from a lot of wars, whether it's the German invasion of Russia, or the U.S. invasion of Iraq, or the Russian invasion of Ukraine more recently, you just pick a war. The basic takeaway that I have is wars are inherently risky and unpredictable, and it's very easy to start a war, but very hard to end a war on your terms. Very, very hard. Very few wars end exactly the way that one side or the other wants. And so I just think that the Trump administration is taking a massive, massive risk here, even though we will all, I probably agree, I'm sure that the Iranian regime is odious. They have the blood of many Iranians and Israelis and Americans and many others on their hands. Ayatollah Khamenei was a horrible, evil ruler, all that kind of stuff. But you know, you kick over the hornet's nest. You don't know what's going to happen, and I feel like, again, kind of a sense of deja vu with the 2003 Iraq War. And I think George Packer put it pretty well in the Atlantic when he wrote that compared to the Bush folks, the Trump folks have equal amounts of hubris but a lot less idealism. And you know, one of the many bizarre aspects of this war is sometimes Trump engages in George W. Bush-style rhetoric about promoting democracy and the hour of freedom is at hand for Iran. But the rest of the time, he's anti-democracy, both at home and abroad, and is making deals with dictators. And in fact, in Venezuela, made a deal with their dictator to replace the dictator that he kidnapped. And he's made pretty obvious that he'd be happy to make a deal with a dictator in Iran if he could find somebody to make a deal with. So it's just a mess, and there are just so many ways this could go wrong.
Okay, let's go back to the Iraq thing and Bush. Okay, I wasn't for that war, but I didn't like Bush. But, you know, it was everything. But there was an intellectual basis for it. It was actually a thought that the American military, if it turned out, it wasn't. It didn't work out the way we thought, but people actually had an idea that through American power, we could change people, we could put a new regime in, that we could remake the world. But there was, and people like yourself and George, by the way, okay? There was actually some idea behind it. And they were like serious people that thought this and thought it for not nefarious reasons, that they thought it would work. And I mean, we all do shit in our lives that we think is going to work, and it turned out it didn't work. But what intelligent people do is they learn from it. Is there any intellectual basis? Is there like the Claremont Institute? Are they producing papers as to why this is a good thing? Or do you know of anything like that? I mean, you're pretty plugged into that world.
I mean, I think to some of the MAGA base, this is kind of a shock, because this isn't what they signed up for, because they thought that Trump was going to be the president of peace. As he himself said, he's going to end wars, not start them. But I think with most of the MAGA base, they're behind Trump because, as he himself said, Trump is MAGA, and it's basically a cult following. So whatever Trump does, they will fall in behind him. But it is shocking to me because, you know, part of the reason why Trump was elected president was also the part of the reason why Barack Obama was elected president was part of this American backlash against these wars of choice and regime change in the Middle East. And here we are in another war of choice and another war of regime change in the Middle East.
Yeah, I just want to make an observation. You talked about the MAGA base. The MAGA base is not sufficient to win very many elections. Okay? And what my ideal is that Trump, his approval among Republicans, by the way, is starting to deteriorate. I mean, if your disapproval among Democrats is 93 and your approval among Republicans is 85, that's 8 points. That's a lot. We you know, the thing about politics is small numbers get amplified.
Right.
And my ideal is for his Republican
approval in midterms,
is 75, but no lower. Where, okay, you can stay on the burning ship or you can jump in the ice cold water, but there's only two choices you got, because you can't win a general election with him and you can't win a primary without him. And it's an advantageous political position to find yourself in. And if he lost to MAGA base, then fuck, the other one wouldn't feel drawn in. You follow where I'm coming from on this?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think this is certainly not going to help him, Republicans, politically in the fall. And I think Trump and the White House are very aware of that. And I think that's part of the reason why there's a ticking clock on this intervention, why he's talking about 4 weeks as his timeline. I think he's concerned about the economic fallout. I think there's concern within the military about drawing down U.S. munition stockpiles to dangerous levels. And there's also, I think, concern about creating a political backlash and adding to the albatross that Republicans are carrying around their necks heading into November. So for all those reasons, I think Trump is incentivized to end the war sooner rather than later.
So, Max, before I turn it over, you're not a Democrat. I understand that, but you observe American politics. You know, thoughtful guy with a steep in. Is there any Democrat that you see out there, the potential presidential candidate, that you would find kind of intriguing to add? If I could spend 20 minutes with this person, I'd like to do a column on him or something. Do you find anybody in the current Democratic filament that's being mentioned as a potential presidential campaign interesting, or somebody you think has something to say that you want to listen to?
I mean, I think the Democrats have a bunch of, you know, credible potential presidents on the bench, whether,
right,
you know, the obvious names, Gavin Newsom, Josh Shapiro, Andy Beshear, Wes Moore, maybe. I'm sure there are others. I mean, right, a lot of them seem, you know, like pretty credible alternatives.
Right. I think coming from a guy like you, it's like, you know, you obviously don't like what you got, to say the least. But I do think, and I'm glad to hear you say that, because I am just impressed, and I'm saying this, I think, as a talent evaluator, not a partisan, the level of talent in the Democratic Party right now is unbelievably high. And I don't think and I don't want people to anticipate it. I want them to see it. But I was at conference with a lot of these statewide candidates, and some of them just, I mean, blow you away talent. But Rob Sand, I'm sorry, he just blows you away with his talent. David Jolly, you got to go down to Florida and talk to David, okay? He's a former Republican congressman. He was actually kind of a deficit scholar almost. I mean, he was a very thoughtful guy, and, you know, he's cross Jordan, man. He's really cross Jordan. Those are some guys I think that a Max Boot would be. It's important. Yeah.
I mean, I would just add to that. I think some of the most impressive figures in the Democratic Party are the veterans. I think folks like Jason Crow, Seth Moulton, Wes Moore, Mark Kelly, various others.
Right. Alyssa Slotkin. There's a whole bunch. Max, let me just ask you a couple quick. I know you have to go, but I think this is an illegal war, and I think the Constitution requires the president. This was not a preemptive score to go to Congress and get authority. He had no interest in doing that. Instead, he did spend time consulting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. What did MBS get out of this, and what do you think Trump got out of this?
I mean, it's a little bit hard to read where MBS and Saudi Arabia are coming from, because there's dueling reports. On the one hand, reports that they were opposed to military action because they were worried about the blowback for obvious reasons. I think maybe MBS got on board when it was obvious the train was leaving the station, but I just don't see MBS as being the prime mover behind this. I think it's really Trump and Netanyahu who ginned up this war together.
And did Netanyahu come out of this stronger?
Well, he hasn't come out of it yet, but
that's true. Good point.
But I mean, there is an election in Israel this year, and I think, you know, he's basically getting to do what he's always wanted to do. I mean, he's been talking for 20 years about removing the Iranian threat, and he's finally getting to do it. And so I think, you know, he's able to probably make a lot of Israeli voters forget about the failure to prevent the October 7th attack. And now he's going to, you know, try to seek re-election as the man who saved Israel from Iran. I mean, we'll see how it plays out. But obviously, you know, I think Israelis are generally in favor of this war, but not so much the case in the U.S., where most people are opposed to it.
You know, I talked to someone who's an expert pollster on Israeli public opinion who agrees that Israelis, at least for now, so much favor this, but they say they have not forgotten about October 7th, that's something that is deeper than Netanyahu would like. But let me ask you, I am not a conspiracy peddler, Max. I promise you I am not. But I can't rule out a wag the dog element here. That was the movie where a president staged a war to knock a sex scandal and political problems off the front page. I don't know any other president I would have said that about, but with Trump, I think you can't rule that out.
I don't know. I mean, I can't read his psychology, but I mean, Democrats for months have been saying that every single thing that Trump does is an attempt to distract from the Epstein scandal. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical because I think, you know, Trump is sharp enough to understand that he's running huge risks here, that this thing could easily blow up in his face. So if this is not like, this is not like 1 or 2 days of bombing or just killing one leader or something like that, this is a major war with massive repercussions. And even if he hasn't given serious thought to how those repercussions will play out, I mean, I think he's got to be aware that this is a major gamble, and one that, as I say, could easily go against him. And frankly, from a political standpoint, I'm not sure how it would help him in any case, because, you know, I don't think a lot of people are going to be turning out to the ballot box in November saying, hey, I'm going to vote for Republicans because Trump killed Ayatollah Khamenei. I just don't see that as a likely scenario. I think most Americans are either opposed or indifferent to this conflict.
Yeah, I agree with you. Max has got to go. James, do you have something else that you'd like to add or ask our distinguished guest?
Max, here for 90 seconds, I want to make a point. Maybe Trump is doing this because he wants to have some legacy achievement, and he's thinking about where it is. Maybe he's doing it to deflect from the Epstein case. I actually am more cynical than both of those explanations. I think Trump is scared to death of the November election, and he's already said it. And in the back of his reptilian mind, he thinks the more disorder that he can generate, the better excuse he has for calling off the election. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I actually believe this. I think he knows if he loses the election, he's done with Epstein because the Democrats are going to subpoena everything, including him. All right. As long as he's got a Republican Congress and, you know, and he's kind of protected. And he knows that November is a swift and impending doom, and he will do everything that he can to have a rationale for calling the election off. I think that's what motivates him. I don't think legacy motivates him. I think he knows that if he loses, he's done with Epstein, but the election is foremost in his mind. That's my view.
Could be. I can't get inside his right. his head. And clearly he wants to influence the outcome of the November election by my means, fair or foul. But I'm just not sure that I agree that his presidency is over if Democrats win in November, because his presidency really doesn't depend on getting legislation approved. It's all about executive action. And, you know, I'm not sure to what extent Democrats can impede his executive action, especially when it comes to foreign affairs.
Well, you know, Max, I know you have to go. I would just add, you're right, but there will be accountability. Those subpoenas will drive them crazy. There is so much stuff, if they do it wisely and selectively, to investigate. There's so much corruption that it won't stop his presidency, but it will give him more than a giant headache.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But unfortunately, I think there's still a lot of room for his action, even if the Democrats are in control of Congress.
I'm afraid I agree. You have been a fabulous guest, James. I think we agree.
Great guest. I'd like anytime you want to come back, Max. I love your perspective, and you know, you've seen and lived through a lot of history and studied a lot of history in your life, and we're very fortunate to be able to get your insight on some of these things. And like anybody that's been in public policy for a long time, you got some good calls and bad calls. And the thing is, you learn from your good calls, but you learn more from your bad calls. Best of luck to you, man.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot to learn from, so thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week. The Trump Justice Department, the worst in history probably, had a momentary moment of sanity when they dropped their case against four Washington law firms. Courts rejected these shakedowns. Even this Supreme Court will side with these firms that had the courage and character to stand up to Trump's bullying. But then the Justice Department reversed itself and said, no, we're not going to give in. They're going to lose, and these firms that stood up deserve the credit. Wilmer Hale, Sussman Godfrey, Perkins Coie, and Jenner and Block. They're going to win. And I'm sorry, Pam Bondi, you know, keep at it, because, baby, you're going to get rolled. Conversely, let's look at those big firms, mainly in New York, that sold their soul for what they saw as bigger riches and capitulated. They include Skadden Arps, Paul Wise, Wilkie Farr, and others. The grandchildren of those first four firms are going to be proud someday. Not so for the capitulators.
Completely. I want to address something I saw. You know, we like sports, we like analogies. Okay, this is the owner of the Los Angeles Angels speaking to reporters during a recent media session addressing the team's payroll and broadcast uncertainty. Billionaire owner Artie Moreno said, I'm quoting, okay? Listen to me. The number one thing fans want is affordability. Uh-huh. They want affordability. They want safety, and they want a good experience when they come to the ballpark. Believe it or not, winning is not in their top five. Hey, Artie, you got to be some kind of goddamn.
He didn't say that. He didn't.
He said that. Artie, the owner of the law, and there's a reason that you've heard of the Los Angeles Dodgers and you have not heard of the Los Angeles Angels. He said, "When believe it or not, winning not in the top five." And that permeates.
You know, the two best players in baseball the last 10 years are probably Mike Trout, Shohei Ohtani. Didn't the Angels have them or have them?
Yes. Yeah, and they have a good ballpark. They got, obviously a large population to draw from. They ain't worth a shit. And the owner says, we don't care. I mean, you can take the affordability argument to extreme stupidity, but somebody doesn't care if they get to pay $2 less for a hot dog. They don't care about the outcome of the game. I don't I don't think that guy understands sports. I don't.
Man.
I mean, Jesus.
I tell you something. He's lucky that Dan Snyder is gone. He's unlucky that Dan Snyder is gone because they lost the worst owner in professional sports. He may be right up there now.
Yeah, I don't know if he's as bad a guy. I don't know him. I don't know if he's a bad guy, but boy, he's got his fucking priorities in the wrong place. I got to tell you, just really got him in the wrong place. And unfortunately, that kind of thinking,
boy,
was a part of a lot of people in the Democratic Party. I think they're diminishing now. I mean, if Trump ain't taught us nothing, he taught us the value of winning.
Yeah, yeah. Texans showed us that this week.
I wish somebody would have said winning is everything, stupid.
Hey, now for the listener questions. Boy, I think they get better every week. But anyway, the first one, James, this is picking up on something you said earlier. Daniel in Anderson, South Carolina. Democrat fundraising efforts, he says, are lagging behind Republicans. I think that's true with the DNC. I don't think it's true in a lot of other places. But Daniel wants to know, who should we support and how would you suggest that we contribute?
Okay. First of all, you're not going to outspend them. Trump has got created $1.5 billion. Cornyn spent $77 million in a primary. You're not going to get to that. That's the bad news. The good news is you don't have to. Okay. A Democrat has not lost an election in this century for a lack of money. And what political dollars do, at some point, after you're in South Carolina, okay, you certainly given everything, let's just say $20 million. Which you can raise, every dollar you spend after that declines in value. And so we're going to raise enough. In terms of what donors that listen to the show, we don't know what I think, the best campaign donation you can make is directly to the candidate. All right? So let's say Ann Andrews, who we're very big on this podcast, and we think she has a real good chance. If you're going to donate $1,000, send it right to her. And the reason is very simple. She has more latitude as to what she can do with that money than if you give it to the state party or you give it to another super PAC or organization or something like that, because they got to do everything. She can take that money. She can buy media at guaranteed the lowest rate. And this, you can't do that with other money. So my advice, unless if you're a $250,000 donor, then, you know, we'll give you some other advice, but if you got a budget that you're going to $2,000 you want to donate,
spread the joy.
Right in candidate's hand. That's the best money you can spend. I would send Talrico a check this morning. Yeah.
James Roy and Ash in Oregon ask, why is there no Project 2025 from the Democrats for a post-midterm strategy to reverse MAGA abuse? Roy, you're getting ahead of yourself. I mean, the most important question right now is winning in 2026. And, you know, James Talarico provided a great start. You're going to win the House. You want to make sure you win the Senate. I hope candidates like Mallory McMurrow and Josh Turek emerge, because I think they can win. So that'll be the focus. After 2026, you can worry about a Project 2029 or whatever have you. There are all kinds of think tanks, but then the candidates themselves will form those ideas and will be open to discussion and debate then. But right now, there's only one thing to focus on in the next 8 months, and that is electing candidates to take over the House and Senate.
Yeah. And look, the thing I would say to our good listener here, and we'll call it, a party without a presidential candidate is not going to have a message. Okay, you just can't. And we're asking for something. Now, individual candidates, and we have overall Democratic message is we ain't Trump, which is a pretty good one, by the way. All right? There's nothing wrong with running against Trump. You don't have to be for a lot more. You don't need a 7-point program. Now, when you get to the presidential race, obviously that is all going to change, because when you run for president, you legitimately got to run, you got to have some ideas you got to run on, and we'll get a lot in the presidential election. But the best message we got is, you know, let Trump know what you really think about him. And if you do that, you're going to win big.
Well, and I think there are things, I agree, but it's not enough. There are specific issues you can run on. You can run on raising a minimum wage. You can raise on taxing billionaires so people, working class people, can get a tax cut. You can run on restoring all those health care cuts, and you could run on any war ought to be approved by Congress. Those are four good issues that are, you know, that are very, I think, real and popular.
So, Mary Petola, I think I'm pronouncing her name right, is a Senate candidate in Alaska. She's got this really good idea that companies that pay their employees more get some kind of tax break. We got to flush it out. But the idea is if I pay people...
Got to get her on the show.
You got to get her on the show. But I had a good talk with David Jolly. Yeah. And I said, look, if you want to reduce the size of government, if you think that the federal government spends too much on food stamps, spends too much on Medicaid, spends too much on heating assistance, I tell you how to deal with that. Raise wages. I say Walmart, I'm going to pick on them or McDonald's, but okay, they're a hugely profitable country, and the people that work for them have to get government assistance because they can't make it on the salary they got. Well, why are you paying for that? But you're paying dividends of a gazillion dollars to their shareholders. Pay your people. Raise the goddamn minimum wage. We hadn't raised the minimum wage since 2009. Now, a lot of states, you know, now a friend from Oregon, I think Oregon has a state-mandated minimum wage, but a lot of people don't, or it's a lot lower. And pay people more. Give companies tax breaks that pay people, you know, a higher salary. And you're going to reduce the size of government in a way that doesn't hurt people. But we're subsidizing huge employers in this country with Democrat-inspired social programs. I'm all for social programs, but I'm all for the companies taking some of this out of their bottom line and not putting it on taxpayers. And the best way to do that, pay people.
Well, I think going back to Henry Ford over a century ago, when you pay people more, it helps the economy. It doesn't hurt the economy.
I thought he was crazy, paying people $5 an hour. He said, no, buy my cars.
James, here's a different but very good question from Mark in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What should responsible parents and leaders be telling high school grads about joining the military?
Oh, my God. Well, I'll be honest with you, Dad. Military officer that said that Jesus had sent Trump to Iran. First of all, I got to get rid of this motherfucker like yesterday. All right, I mean, now. That's insane. If you want to get people military, don't tell somebody send your kid to us because Jesus wants him to go to Iran and die. That's not a good message. Look, I think I could give you a lot of arguments. You know, first of all, you graduate from high school, a lot of people just don't know what they want to do for the next 3 or 4 years. You're going to get trained. You're going to get, you know, you're going to get 3 hots in a cot that you're going to be able to get an education after. You're going to, you know, you're going to get to see, you obviously can get to travel when, you know, there's some risk, but there's some, you know, you get a lot of camaraderie in the military. You make really good friends. You learn things. You develop skills. I think it's a great idea for a youngster to join the military. I really do. And I think he just was so fortunate. And when I was in, you got so many benefits when you got out and just throwing money at veterans. I think we should, you know, do that. But, you know, look and see what your bottom line is and what happens after you get out, what skills you get. I'd recommend to most young people it's something you ought to really look hard at. But you can't have these goofy fucking officers leading you in some kind of biblically inspired Armageddon.
Well, I would add, this is slightly different, but I would add to that, let's also work to undo the damage that this administration is doing to those great service academies, West Point and Annapolis, because those are such great training grounds for you know, the best military in the world, and they are doing awful things there, as our friend Ty Schedule and Gordon over at Annapolis have told us. But James, Philip in Birmingham asked a question which really, really
I got to admit, really hurts me. It's not the question, but what I'm afraid will be my answer. What do you think of the fate of CNN, Philip asks, will now be that Warner Brothers has agreed to sell its company to Paramount? I am very pessimistic. The Ellisons have no interest in good, honest journalism. We've seen that at CBS. I think they have some great, they have their problems at CNN. Look at the audiences. They haven't been good, but they have some great talent there. I'm afraid already there's stories of one of the Ellisons talking in the White and the Oval Office to Trump about which anchors he wants to get rid of. And, you know, in a time of crisis, I watch CNN a lot the last 3 days, because in a time of crisis, you turn to CNN. And I think what Ted Turner started some, you know, 44, 46, 7 years ago, I think is going to be degraded a great deal by the Ellisons.
Okay, so I guess I'd say this. First of all, David Zasloff is a good friend. Okay, he bought my movie. I think he's done. By the way, I don't know what they are. They're getting a shitload of money for it. But I'm not sure. The Ellison thing is as solid an offer as you think. I mean, there's a lot of due diligence left. And they're talking about $111 million. And they're talking about issuing a shitload of debt or something. I don't know if this thing is guaranteed to close. And, you know, Netflix is a wealthy, powerful company, and they were up to like $79 million, whatever it was, okay? I mean, they were going to put, $1 billion, something, okay? Let's see if this goes through, if they come up with the money, because I don't think it's a given. And I think David, I mean, the Warner Bros. Discovery, man, their shareholders did doing really well with this thing. I mean, that's really what a corporation does is, sometimes, you know, delivers value to shareholders. And my hat's off to David Zasloff. You got this in yourself too. Great. A lot of shareholder value.
Well, I think it's, I hope you're right. David Zasloff's going to be rich no matter what. But yeah. I hope you're right. I'm skeptical that it won't go through. I'm skeptical.
I don't know
rather,
if right. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying.
And you put your fingers on the debt will be humongous. And what does that mean? That means layoffs. That means cutbacks. That means deteriorating quality, whether it's in movies or CNN or streaming or anything else. And yeah, they'll be the biggest media moguls in the world and all that stuff. But boy, if it does go through, what they have, I think, is going to not wear well in history. Let me just put it that way.
It'll probably go through. You're probably right, but there's a lot of green here between, as you say, in the pool hall. There's a lot of green. They got to go to get to that point to get the ball in the two-ball
in
the pocket.
Well, there is that. James, I'm going to combine two questions to you. One is from Russ in Plainfield, New Jersey, who says, well, can America survive 3 more years of Trump? It's getting worse as he gets more unhinged. And John in Tempe, Arizona, who says, what do I say to my friends who think we live in a totalitarian country and there may well not be elections in November?
Okay. So I actually have given this some thought a lot. And so people come to me and we do this. What can an average citizen do? So I spent out in Tempe, Arizona. Okay, great American. He was very worried about it legitimately. And you say to yourself, you know, I'm one plug. I'm one guy in a swing state, and I'm worried about not having an election. And you can, you know, if you see Senator Gallego or Senator Kelly, you know, say, hey, you know, they're going to be with you 100%. What we need to do, there are two things. One is, I got some people working on this. We can work on it. Draft a letter, but have it, and every Democrat, and that guy in Tempe, he has Republican friends, okay? Send this to your congressman or your senator, whoever it is, and say, I am a Republican. I am going to vote Republican in November, but I don't want to hear any talk about not having an election, okay? And get Republican signatories. So you send that to the Senate. And because if he gets Al Hunt and James Carville write a letter to Tim Scott, he doesn't give a shit because we're not going to vote for him anyway. But if he got 15 Republicans saying, sent to Scott, I want a chance to vote Republican. If you don't have this election, this is going to be terrible. Do that. That's going to be way more valuable than organizing the Democratic committee in your county. All right. Pick them out. The next thing we can do, and this is an assignment for you and I and other people, and we got to get the question. Now, understanding politics is we're a very part about political strategy. Let's make it akin to tennis. They always return your serve. All right? So you throw the ball there. I'm not a tennis player, but I mean, I know the rules. And you sit it, and you know, it's always going to come back to you. So the third shot in politics is the kill shot. It's either going to kill them or it's going to kill you. And you know this because you've covered it all your life. They say something, you say something, they say right. Something, then you say something. And we got to frame a question that every Republican that goes on any show or any town hall that's airtight about having the election. And then we know what they're going to say. They're going to say, look, I want to have the election, but if it's not going to be fair, you know, that's the main thing we got to be sure that this election is fair. No. Okay. Now they said this. So wait a minute. We had an election in 1918. We had an election in 1942. We had an election in 1862. Are you telling me, is this what you're really saying? That you got to be convinced that we actually can have an honest election when we've had we have some of the most honest elections we have? We got to drill down on this and drill down and frame the question. And they're going to wiggle out of it. You know what they're going to say. And so what we need to talk about, we can talk about it next week. They don't have to come up with it by the end of the month, but we got to come up with it by, this spring sometimes, and if they go on, if they go on a talk show or an interview or anything like that, every fucking town hall that they have, we got to send people to it. And ask Lindsey Graham, how committed are you to having an election? And you know that son of a bitch is going to wiggle and squirm and try to come up with anything. Oh, well, I want to have the election, but if I don't see it, you blah, blah. No. And, Pam was really effective is showing up at these town halls. don't sit there and say, I have no power. That is not true.
It is.
It's not true. And you have the power to go and ask them. You have the power to get friends of yours who are Republicans to send a letter to some Republican senator saying, no, you can't do this. And you got to raise the stakes because we got the one thing they don't have, and this is important, and remember this, they don't have the element of surprise. That's big. That's a good opening volley we got. We're warning people. The second thing we got to do is have not just an airtight question. We got to have the third volley be airtight, and we can work on that, and we can do that, and it can help.
Yeah, it's a good thing to work on in the weeks and months ahead. Eric in Marlboro, New Jersey, said he's very excited for the November elections in a blue wave, but he's worried we're going to get too overconfident and it may not be materialized. Talk me down. Eric, that's easy. When you get your list of worries you have, I don't know, taxes, your property taxes, picking up the garbage, how the one kid may be doing in school, cross off worried about a lack of enthusiasm in November. It's going to happen. That enthusiasm, if anything, is going to increase. I'll give you just two examples. Number one, Texas on Tuesday. Not only did Tallarico win, it was a huge turnout. That enthusiasm is off the charts. And number two, in your own state of New Jersey, if you remember only 3 or 4 months ago, people were wringing their hands. Maybe Mikey Sherrill's in real trouble. Well, she won by 14.5 points for governor and with a huge turnout. Enthusiasm will continue. So, Eric, I've done you a big favor. There are other things you can worry about.
So let me really agree with you. Okay, but let me frame the argument I get sometimes. is, James, I love it to see you go out there and you're so confident. But you know what worries me is people are going to listen to you and they're going to get complacent. All right. I think that argument, that observation is totally wrong. I think the idea of optimism and talking about winning creates its own momentum. And if people think that their candidate right. or their party is going to win, it makes them excited to vote. If you think your candidate is going to lose, you're not very excited about voting. All right? I mean, that's so the original assumption is don't say that. You want to keep people on the edge of their seats. You want to tell them that there's drama when, in fact, you kind of know we're going to win the election anyway. And I think that gets more people to vote than tell them that it's really close. But that's the argument our friend that wrote in, and it's an intelligent question. It's a good question. You and I just completely disagree with the outcome, but people do believe like this, and I think it's wrong.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, James. The final question is this: I really mean this is a very, very, very tough one. Eric in Lacey, Washington, asks, which Trump department will have the most negative impact on the most people in the United States? He suggests HHS because its policies affect all, but there are other candidates. Which department do you think will have the most negative impact on America?
I guess I would say Treasury. And I say that because there's a lot of stuff that Trump's done, like in Homeland Security, which is just... Oh, right, that fucking White House. Oh my God, man. I got to send that guy. His question of Kristi Noem was like one of the great congressional testimony disasters that you could imagine. But we're not going to fix, and you got to look at the CBO report, is the amount of debt that is being piled on by this administration that's going to have to be paid back in the out years. You're talking about the 2036, which, you know, budget projections, you've covered this all your life. I mean, it's not golden, what they say, but they put a lot of thought into it. It's going to be like, I don't know, how many trillions of dollars they're talking about. And we've just become sort of immune to, like, deficit stories and debt stories. The Cassandras and the deficit skulls and that kind of stuff. You know, they got a point. If you look at it, we need to do a show or something. I'll do some research on the next show. You cannot believe the budget projections that the next president's going to be faced with. You're just not going to be able to believe it. And our friend Roger Alt will tell you, once you get to the point where these sovereign wealth funds and these big pension funds and everything, when they start demanding a premium to hold these treasuries, watch out, people. Most important number in all economics in the United States is the price of a 10-year treasury, and it's in jeopardy right now. It's in jeopardy.
James, for me, picking the worst is the reverse of college basketball, picking the best. Who's the best? Duke, Arizona, Michigan, UConn. That's a really hard choice because they're all really, really good. And there's so many departments that are so bad. I think your pick of Treasury is a good one. I guess I would pick Justice because I think the rule of law underpins everything in a democratic society. And we have a Justice Department that simply does not believe in the rule of law. And I think that affects us all. And I think the harm they're doing is great. We will recover some, but it's not going to be a recovery that can take place immediately.
Yeah, I guess I'll bargain with you somewhat for the sake of it. You get a good attorney general, and they can reverse Justice Department policies. They can try to bring their skilled lawyers everywhere. It's a disaster. Maybe the Supreme Court. Could we have to live with that shit forever that they come up with, and it's kind of hard to unring that bell. I think the next attorney general is highly likely to try to restore some dignity to the Justice Department, some professionalism, and they might be able to do that, but the debt ain't going anywhere, and the Supreme Court rulings ain't going anywhere. They're kind of entrenched.
Right. James, I got one more for you. This is one that's coming right down the middle. It's ready for you. John in Sea Ranch, California, want to know, what did you think of that Comer House Committee calling the Clintons, and how did they do?
Okay, so the question is, they called the Clintons, they testified under oath remotely to the committee. Okay, so you call Bill Clinton, okay, you could say that there is evidence that Bill Clinton knew Jeffrey Epstein, and I think it's legitimate to ask him about it, all right? There's no evidence that Hillary even knew him. Tell me, in the name of God, Trump has mentioned how many times in the Epstein files or whatever, Hillary's mentioned none. How do you justify having her called under oath and not Trump or not Melania? There's evidence that they knew her. There's no evidence that she did. And by the way, when the Democrats get back in power, and they're going to do that, okay, they're going to call. And Trump's going to, the one golden thing that they did is they've set the precedent. Okay, there's no presidential immunity from doing chicken shit congressional stuff. So that was a Comer, but I think he fucked it up, but he's stupid anyway. So what did you expect to do that? And actually, Clinton was quite good in the deposition from the clips that people have sent me. So I think they got nothing yeah. out of it, and I think that it was a long term disaster for them. I think that they're stupid and they fucked the whole thing up. And you're going to see more Epstein shit come January. Oh my God, a year from now, you're going to be drowning in Epstein stuff. It's not going anywhere. It's going to explode more.
Yeah. It is not going away. They are now being forced to call Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, who is in those files, denied he saw Epstein after, I don't know, 2005. There's a picture of him on the beach, 4 or 5 years later with Epstein. So he's coming. And they ought to call people like Leon Black, Apollo's Leo Black, who's all over the Epstein files. See if Mr. Comer can rise to the occasion. I don't think he will, but I think next year with Chairman Garcia, I think you can look at a number of these people being up there.
It's a year from now. What's the date? The 3rd? 4th? You're going to know so much on March the 4th, 2027, you're going to be drowning in information.
Okay. Hey, we love those questions. We really do. So please keep them coming. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. It's one of our favorite segments every week. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.